This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. To be black and an intellectual in America is to live in a box, writes my guest Stephen Carter. People see the box, read the label, and imagine that they have seen you. The labels range from caution, black left-wing activist, handle with care or be accused of racism, to caution, black neoconservative, probably a nutcase, or warning, affirmative action baby, do not assume that this person is qualified. Well, Carter is a beneficiary of affirmative action, and in his new book, he chronicles the ambivalence and frustration that accompany the benefits. Carter says he couldn't exactly call his background disadvantaged. His father was a university professor. His mother was an aide to Georgia State Senator Julian Bond. Stephen Carter is a law professor at Yale. His new book is called Reflections of an Affirmative Action Baby. But the book goes beyond affirmative action to discuss the dilemmas of the black intellectual. There is, for instance, the assumption that as a black person, there are things you simply know better than white people do.
I think that one of the things that has happened in recent years has been a movement toward the view that there is a particular black perspective which is richer and deeper than the perspective that other people, say, for example, white people, have on a variety of issues, most of them touching race. I would be the last person to deny that history as well as our experience in this nation makes black people different from white people. I think people understand that. The trouble that I have is with the view that this experience makes black people different in a particular and predictable way. My concern is that there is a growing sense that if one is black, one is only authentically black if one has a particular set of political positions or a particular aesthetic, particular things one values culturally, and so on. This is part of a larger problem of labeling in our society, a problem that particularly touches the black community. And one of the things I'm trying to do in this book is battle against the idea that there's a right way to be black or a right way indeed to be American or white or anything else.
In that view that there is a particular right way to be black, what is the profile of that personality who would be black in the right way?
Well, it's hard to say exactly what the profile is. I think it erupts on particular issues. I think you see a lot of this in the debate over Clarence Thomas and his nomination to succeed Justice Marshall. Now, you should understand that as a constitutional scholar who, in fact, has written a great deal about the confirmation process, I think of myself as an observer of these processes. I never take positions for or against any nominee. But I do think that you can see by looking at the arguments over the Clarence Thomas nomination a sense that many people have that if he were more authentically black, if he were not, as one critic said in a major newspaper recently, if he were not estranged from the values of most black people, that he would hold a set of views that I think would be identified as more liberal, perhaps on civil rights issues, for example, and maybe on other issues as well.
You know, but I think part of where that comes from is the sense that black people have felt disenfranchised in a lot of the political process and in the judicial process. So when a president is ready to actually, you know, appoint a black judge, and a lot of people feel that his experience or his views are so different from the majority views of blacks that it's like, well, we gave you your person, you know, and
sure,
you know, and that's all you're going to get. You're going to get this one person, and this one person doesn't relate to what it is you wanted represented in the first place.
Well, I think it's certainly true that black people have been disfranchised in the political process in America. And if one wants to talk in terms of being represented on the court, however, I think one has to think about something a little bit different. There are two things that have to be said about the racial context, of the Clarence Thomas nomination.
Mm-hmm.
One is, of course, that he's succeeding Thurgood Marshall, for whom it was my privilege to serve as a law clerk 10 years ago. Thurgood Marshall is one of the great figures of American legal history, even quite apart from his exemplary service on the Supreme Court. And anyone who followed him, black or white, I think was going to be looked at by a lot of people as someone who ought to be filling his shoes in the sense of following his policies. But we're not going to get that from this president and this political climate. That is, black, white, Hispanic, whoever the next nominee was, it was clearly not going to be someone and if Judge Thomas's nomination should be rejected by the Senate, it would still not be someone who is going to fit that political model. But I think that when you talk, as you did a moment ago, about the view that some people have that if there is going to be a black nominee, it ought to be someone who in some sense represents the community, I think it's important to do what I think the media does all too infrequently, and that's look more deeply at the politics of the black community. It is true that the black community is, as we identify these issues on the spectrum in America, more liberal than the nation as a whole on issues regarding race and social welfare policy, but on a host of other issues, from the rights of women to school prayer to abortion, what you find is that the black community tends to be in surveys to the right of the nation as a whole on these issues. So if one wants to get serious about representing the community, I suppose one ought to represent those views too. My feeling about this is that Supreme Court justices should not be charged with representing anybody, that rather what they should be doing is be people who have considerable legal background and are sufficiently open-minded that they will listen to both sides of a question before making up their minds.
I guess, too, there's this feeling that a lot of times white people in power who get to kind of appoint or choose or hire the one black person who they'll probably let in will choose that one black person who makes the white people feel most comfortable, who most reinforces their point of view.
Well, I would say this. I think that it is certainly true that white people on the right or the left who want to express views about race like to have a black person to point to and say, see, he agrees with me or see, she agrees with me. That means my view is validated.
Mm-hmm.
My position, I think that's ridiculous. That is, I don't think that a view about race in America ought to get more credence because it comes from someone black. And I think that one thing that is very healthy in the debate over Clarence Thomas is that black people disagree with him are willing to say so. I think that's good. I don't think that the fact that he's black means, therefore, his views on civil rights are immune from criticism. I think the fact that the traditional civil rights leaders are black means that their views on civil rights issues are immune from criticism. The issues always ought to be the merits of the view expressed, whether it is a good idea or a bad idea, rather than the race of the person who's expressing it.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stephen Carter. He's a professor of law at Yale University and author of a new book called Reflections of an Affirmative Action Baby. As an intellectual, you write that you felt a lot of conflict between solidarity and independent thinking. Why are those two so often in conflict in your mind?
Well, I don't think they're in conflict. I'm sorry if my book left that impression. I think there's no conflict between the demands of solidarity and the demands of independence. I think there are some people who believe that one cannot genuinely love one's people or genuinely be a black person unless one has the right set of views. But I don't think solidarity is an impediment to independent thinking, and I'm disturbed when I read that there are people who do think that. I think on the contrary, that a love for one's people, which is the underlying theme of solidarity in my mind, a deep and abiding love for one's people, can lead to dissent, can lead to the pointing out of the possibility of error. That I think that that kind of open and respectful dissent can be a much greater act of loyalty than the often empty words of agreement that I think every community likes to hear.
Part of your book is a dialogue with yourself about affirmative action, about its benefits, and about the problems associated with it. You feel that you've benefited by affirmative action in a lot of ways, which doesn't mean that you're not ambivalent about it and critical of the way it's often handled. Let's talk first about how you feel you've benefited by affirmative action.
Well, I've had a lot of benefits from affirmative action, I think. I don't know much about the process of my college admission. I do know that I would not have been admitted to a top law school if I weren't black. And as I relate in the book, the reason I know that is that when I was a senior in college, I applied to a number of law schools. I was admitted to all of them quite quickly, except for Harvard, which after some time sent me a letter of rejection. And then within 2 days, I received agonized phone calls from two Harvard officials and a professor telling me that they'd made a mistake and that they had, as one of them put it, we assumed from your background that you were white. So having discovered that I was black, they decided to admit me to Harvard Law School. Now, I was offended by this, and so I went off to Yale, even though I have no reason to think that Yale, which is a much more selective law school, would have admitted me had I not been black either. I think that you see a lot of black people nowadays who, as I did back then, take offense at the idea that affirmative action played a role in their backgrounds. I think it's a mistake to take offense at it. That is, I think if one is going to support affirmative action in college and professional school admissions, as I generally do, that one has to be willing to admit that they're beneficiaries, that one has to not be insulted when one is thought to be a beneficiary, and that the only way of resolving the ambivalence that may lead to one's feeling insulted by being called a beneficiary of affirmative action is to go out and work hard enough that one develops a record that's sufficiently strong that the doubters can be shown the record and said, how can you say I don't belong here? Look at what I've accomplished.
Well, what are some examples of things, subtle or not so subtle, that were said directly to you that you thought were an example of what's gone wrong in assumptions about affirmative action?
I'll tell you two of my favorite stories, favorite in a sense. That is, they're not particularly pleasant stories. One of the stories involved a paper that another legal scholar wrote. When I was early in my scholarly career, a scholar at another school sent me a paper criticizing some of my work. He sent me a draft to get my comments, which is what one often does with when you're criticizing someone else's work. And in his draft, he said that I was insensitive to the struggle of black people in America. When he discovered that I was black, he took it out. And it's as though his view is that if you're black, you can't possibly be insensitive to the struggle of black people in America, whereas it strikes me that a black person is just as capable of that kind of insensitivity as a white person is. Well, I'd like to think a little less capable, but the black person is still capable of it. In any case, if a person thinks that this particular black person got it wrong, and if the critic thinks that racial insensitivity is a valid charge to bring generally, then one should be willing to bring it against a black person as well as a white person. I said I'd tell you two stories. I was at a conference, and a gentleman came up to me, a young white man. He was neatly dressed, brand new-looking suit, and he looked at my name tag and discovered that I was at Yale Law School, and he said, oh, he said, if you're at Yale Law School, you must know Professor Carter, who wrote this article about thus and so. And when he discovered that I was Professor Carter, he said, oh, he said, you're Carter. And I'd always thought that perhaps if I'd been white, he would have said, oh, you're Carter. And I think that anyway, he was surprised. And he went on then to laud my article in terms so absurd that he must have sounded like a fool. But the remarkable thing is that there is a strange and uneasy relationship that many white intellectuals have to black intellectuals, in which white intellectuals in many cases seem reluctant, let's say, reluctant to criticize the work of black intellectuals, I assume because the white intellectuals are trying to avoid the racist label. I think that's bad. I think that the work of black intellectuals needs criticism just as much as the work of white intellectuals. It's through the process of criticism and dialogue that human learning is advanced.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Stephen Carter. He's a professor of law at Yale University and author of a new book called Reflections of an Affirmative Action Baby. We're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Yale law professor Stephen Carter is my guest, author of the new book Reflections of an Affirmative Action Baby. Can you give us a sense of what the ideal affirmative action type program would be in your mind, one that would really serve the function you'd like to see such a program serve without getting into the stereotyping and the groupthink that you're afraid affirmative action has played
well,
into?
I cannot sketch for you the ideal program because the prescriptive parts of my book about affirmative action are directed much more toward the mindset of those like me who are beneficiaries or potential beneficiaries than toward the institution. Institutions will offer affirmative action programs in a bewildering variety. And I suppose that part of my counsel to black people who have the option of accepting them is if they offer you affirmative action, go ahead and run with it, but don't settle for it. And what I mean by don't settle for it is this, that the mission of every professional, this is the professionals I'm largely concerned about, the mission of every professional ultimately is excellence. It is achieving on the same basis as everybody else. My view is that the ideal position for the beneficiary of an affirmative action program is to be able to say something like this. I may have had a leg up in my college admission, but look at what I did in college. I may have had a leg up in my law school admission too, or my medical school admission, or my business school, or my graduate school admission, whatever it might have been. But Now that I've had these 6 or 7 or 8 or 10 years to show what I'm able to do, I want to stand on my own achievements. I demand to be judged by the same standards as everybody else. This seems to me to be the goal toward which we who are black should be working, whatever the bewildering variety of programs that are offered us by institutions.
So to sum up here, though, you do think that affirmative action programs should be continued, but that the people who benefit by them shouldn't be judged by a different standard.
Well, I would put it this way.
Yeah.
I would say that I certainly support affirmative action in the sense of reaching out to give educational opportunities to people who might not otherwise have them, the chance to go to college, the chance to go to a professional school. Beyond that, rather than say the program should be continued, what I want to say instead is, or I should say rather than say the program should be continued or abandoned, what I want to say instead is that every beneficiary should want to draw a line somewhere and say at this point, excuse me, at this point I've shown what I can do, I don't want it anymore. I think you can have a debate over where the line should be drawn. I think my preference would be to draw it a little earlier when one's education is finished. Excuse me again. My preference would be to draw it a little earlier when one's education is finished. Other people might prefer to draw it at another time. But wherever it's going to be drawn, I do think that every one of us who is a black professional, as well as everyone who's thinking of how to design an affirmative action program, should want to draw the line somewhere.
In what ways do you think your view of affirmative action contrasts with people who wholeheartedly support affirmative action programs?
I think there are a couple of aspects of my view about affirmative action that perhaps are different from what you described as wholehearted support. First of all, I think that we live in a political era in which supporters of affirmative action think the programs are sufficiently threatened that they think it is a high-risk proposition to talk about the costs or the difficulties or complexities of affirmative action. A lot of what I'm trying to do in the book is to recover the distinction between criticism and opposition, to make the case that I can criticize affirmative action, point out its costs and flaws without necessarily being labeled, I hope, as a thoroughgoing opponent. When I talk about my principal concern, which is that we're moving toward a form of affirmative action, which sees affirmative action as representation, I think there, too, I may run into some small disagreement. When I say affirmative action is representation, what I'm talking about is the contemporary view, which is prevalent on college campuses but is also leaking out elsewhere, that the reason to have affirmative action programs is no longer mostly to give people opportunities to show what they can do, but the reason to have the programs is because there is this special voice of the oppressed, the special voice of black America that needs to be brought into the corridors of power. This is an idea that has a great deal of currency, and I am certainly a fan of integration. I love the idea of integrating the corridors of power. But I don't have any illusions. I think it's dangerous for other people to suggest that the reason to do this is because there is a special and, dare I say it, correct black voice that otherwise will not be represented. Indeed, I think that probably my strongest disagreement with the way that many people currently conceive of affirmative action is exactly that. Is my sense that it is a tragic error to push the view that there is a correct way to be black, and that view, I fear, is the logical outcome of the argument that says the reason to integrate the corridors of power is to get the black voice heard.
I'm wondering if you've ever felt when you've worked in a circle that is predominantly white, like, say, Yale University, do you ever feel that white people put pressure on you to kind of signify being black, to stand for, like, the whole African-American population in some way, you know, to be their proxy in some way?
Sometimes. That is, I think sometimes there is an assumption by white people that if you're black, you have a special expertise about the problems of black America, and they should freely talk to you about whatever may be on their mind that day. That happens sometimes, sure, but I think it happens perhaps less frequently than one might otherwise fear. I think I have my concern is largely in a different direction. I have two concerns that are rather different about being a black person in a largely white atmosphere. One of the concerns, although I don't want to overemphasize this, there is of course the concern about what one's colleagues really think. That is, are they really thinking all along that this is my scholarship, for example, is good or not? But you can't get too involved in that, because if you get too involved in worrying all the time about what white people think of you, you're down a road that you'll never get off of. And so after a while, I've just got to stop worrying about that and do your work. There's another worry I have, though, which is what you might think was the political worry. And that runs something like this. I am known, of course, to my colleagues as someone who has views on some aspects of affirmative action that are a little bit different than what one might think of as the liberal tradition. As far as I know, those are the only, shall we say, policy or political views of mine of which my colleagues are aware. Nevertheless, I was astonished to be sitting at lunch one day and be introduced to a total stranger as one of the two leading social conservatives on the Yale faculty. Indeed, a prominent member of the Yale faculty made a speech to alumni in which he referred to me as a very conservative member of the Yale faculty. There's this remarkable thing that goes on when you get into the labeling that often happens, which is that black people are labeled along political lines only on the issue of race. And if one dissents on any point, however small, of the traditional civil rights agenda, one is immediately stuck with this absurd label, black conservative. No one else in America is labeled, except on college campuses, is labeled conservative or liberal based on their views on affirmative action. Since most white people oppose affirmative action in most of its forms, it'll be difficult to do the labeling that way. So with other people, as I say, with other people, you look into their views on what, abortion, prayer in the public schools, the rights of criminal defendants, foreign policy, and so on and so on. But if you're black, and this is as true at Yale as anywhere else, if you're black, all people really need to know in order to categorize you politically is, what do you think about affirmative action? And if you have anything critical to say about it, oh, well, clearly you are a leading social conservative.
Stephen Carter, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Stephen Carter is a professor of law at Yale University and author of a new book called Reflections of an Affirmative Action Baby. And it's just been published by Basic Books. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.